Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This week, we talk with Nathan Palmer about teaching sociology in the internet age. Nathan talks about his website, Sociology Source, the Soc 101 class pack, and how we should be excited, not scared, about what the internet can do for our teaching. I'm here with Nathan Palmer from the Sociology Department at Georgia Southern and SociologySource.com, a website devoted to resources and ideas for teaching sociology. As well, I might add, as claims about Nathan's impeccable hygiene, which...
Indeed.
Which I can, you know, I mean, we're doing this over Skype. You look good.
Thank you.
So, and you are nice and approachable, which you also say. So I just want to verify for those wondering if it's true.
Yeah.
It really is true. Nathan, thanks for joining us. Sorry for giving you a hard time right off the bat.
No. Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So there's a lot we could talk about, but I think I want to start off talking about one project of yours that you've done recently that's gotten some attention on Sociology Source, the Soc 101 Class Pack. Can you start, just tell us what this is and why you're doing it?
Sure. Okay, so the idea was, I'll tell you what it is and then I'll tell you the idea. So it's a collection of resources that I use right now to teach my Soc 101 class. And I'm teaching, actually at the moment, three sections, small sections and really large sections. And I tried to come up with a product that was scalable and was customizable so that other people could see how I do it, and if they liked it, which is a big if, but if they liked it, they could integrate it into their classes. And I tried to make it so that I don't think that many people will probably adopt it, so to speak, and make that like their entire course. But I think that people will take pieces of it and ideas from it and maybe, see new ways of implementing it. Go ahead.
Oh, so it really did start as something that you're doing for yourself to help organize your own teaching across multiple sections. And then you thought, hey, let's share it with the world.
Yeah. I think that the academia in general, and maybe even book publishers and all the institutions that surround education have been relatively slow to adopt the opportunities that are available via the internet. And this idea was just, what if we had like open source classware? Like, instead of open source software, open source classware. Like, I'll put it up there. I'll put a Creative Commons license on it because I don't want someone, a publisher, to take it and then package it as a saleable item, so to speak. But at this point, anyone could, take the class and they could fork it, as they say, in software, and then, make a class pack of their own, and they could take it in a whole new direction. And I'm not... I would be excited and thrilled that someone chose to do that, as opposed to, trying to be, that's mine. Like, mm-hmm. who are you to take my stuff? Mm-hmm. And the idea is just that there's so many opportunities for, you and I and all of our colleagues to leverage technology to make our jobs simultaneously easier, make it easier to work together, and then also at the same time make it easier to what I call teach with humanity, to really connect with students and to find ways to use technology and to work together to manage. And I'm teaching at the moment 360 students, which is a lot. And how do I have a real connection with half of them? And how do I have a decent connection with all of them? Those are really tough questions. And I think that it's tempting to kind of throw our hands up and go, well, our bosses don't really want us to do that. They don't really care. It's a factory. Like, we're just processing students. And I think that that's an option. I think that's a quick option. Or the end of that will be that we will increasingly be replaced, if we can be. And I think that if we take the opportunity to realize how we can get help, I keep going back to technology, but use technology to manage these unrealistic at times expectations, to make them realistic, to make it possible. And I think a big part of that has to be to collaborate. And so I've made the class pack, and it's free. It's always going to be free. I'm not associated with any publisher. This is not a get rich quick scheme, I promise you. If it is, I'm losing money, so this is not
a good one anyway.
I'm all wrong, but the idea is I'll put some skin in the game. I spent a lot of time putting it together and making it available to everybody else, and I just hope that if I share radically, maybe as you might call it, someone else will be inspired to do the same, and then we can start collaborating. We can start really working together and move beyond departments and move beyond all of the barriers, all of the bureaucratic red tape, as we sociologists love to talk about, and just say, well, what if I just give and then you just give and then we figure out where this will work together? And that's the idea.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. And the thing to me is, and I don't know if every department's like this, but I kind of assume that more or less every department has this where, there's a bunch of people teach intro in our department and everyone shares syllabi and, lecture ideas and exercises. Yep. And within the department, we've got a real community around that. There are resources for people. It's not like, everyone's on their own when they start their own intro course. But for some reason, it seemed, if outside of that, there are journals like Teaching Sociology and ASA has, packets that you can purchase, but it seems like all you're doing is basically taking that model that everyone already knows already, within their own department and putting it online and saying, let's take, these exercises that, these exercises, these readings, these things that people can really use and put them out there. And put that way, it doesn't sound all that revolutionary, does it? But you've gotten some interesting reactions, right?
Yeah. To kind of, I guess, summarize how I see what you just said, it's like, what if we took all of the great ideas and all of the things that we do individually in departments, and that, ASA has Trials, which is a subscription-based service that allows you to download teaching activities similar to what my website would do. And there is the journal, and there are peer-reviewed outlets, which I think are very valuable. But my idea is let's drop all of the barriers to as low as possible, to the point where you need an internet connection and a keyboard, and unfortunately, because it's only in English, the ability to read and write English. And then you can get all the resources that I have. And so drop the barriers down to the bottom. But yeah, it doesn't sound like it's that revolutionary of an idea in the sense that it's doing really nothing new, but doing old things in new ways, mm-hmm. or perhaps on a new medium. Yeah. But yeah, the reactions I've got have been... I would say, to be honest, the critiques stick out in my head the most. But I should say that I've been blessed and fortunate to get a lot of encouragement from, I would say, 90% of the people, even maybe higher than that, who have seen the class pack, seen the site. It's been nothing but encouragement, and all of that has really fueled me to keep trying harder, to put more time into it, to spend more, to make more, to give more, and so that has been immensely rewarding. But the responses, I guess if you would call them a critique of what I'm doing, I think the concerns have been, well, what does something like this mean for peer-reviewed research? Like, how does this jeopardize SOL, the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning? And the other, I guess, kind of question is, how do we vouch for the quality of what's on there? I think that's another concern that people have. And the final one, which I have kind of come across, is, well, if we start giving away these resources for free, what's stopping a for-profit school or a school in another part of the world or anything like that from just taking this and mass-producing it, and then we'll all lose our jobs? So maybe I should start at the beginning. The idea of, will this jeopardize SOTL? Will this jeopardize the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning? And peer-reviewed resources like Teaching Sociology? And I think no, it won't, because everything that I'm doing is, and I don't mean this to sound in a negative way, but it's not, I guess, recognized by my institution as like a scholarly publication or anything like that. And so as long as the scholarship of teaching and learning and teaching sociology and outlets like that remain peer-reviewed and remain and are honored by institutions, I think that they'll always have it have its place. I would also say, and this kind of gets to the quality question, that if you want an airtight activity that has been checked on every level, that is vouched by a, you know, a committee of peers and experts, then don't come to my website. You know, go to Teaching Sociology, go to all the other, you know, SOTL journals, because they are they're airtight. If, on the other hand, you trust, I guess, yourself and you trust your colleagues enough to, you know, kind of use the sniff test, and if the teaching resource that I put up there doesn't seem like it's actually good, or maybe it's based off of an error, which, for the record, I acknowledge I'm more than capable of. And so, you know, if you have confidence that you can actually sniff out a good resource or a bad resource, then I think that my website's fine, you know. And in the end, I'm not saying this is the right way to do things, or this is, you know, the only way. Especially, I'm never saying it's the only way. I'm saying this is how I did it, and this is what how it worked for me. And I write about my successes, and oftentimes I don't write about my failures, so to speak. So I'm telling you, this really worked for me, and I hope it will work for you. I hope you can have the same amazing experience that I had, and really reach students. The final thing, I guess, the final critique is, well, what will happen if, you know, these resources are online? Why will I continue to get paid? And actually, in a post that I wrote called the, I guess it was my manifesto, the Sociology Source Manifesto, I said, one of the titles was, you know, teach sociology for change, or teach sociology for change, as in pennies, right? And my whole idea here is that if you can be replaced by my website, then I think your problem is multifaceted and not just that I posted it on the internet. And for the record, even the class pack itself, it has you know, slides and lecture notes. Well, not lecture notes, notes for the students to take, which we should probably talk about here in a second. But and activities and assignments, but it doesn't tell you what to say. It doesn't, like, my slides are not bullet points, so you just can't stand up there and read what I had to say. You have to come up with that. So it's kind of, you know, bring your own brain, BYOB teaching, so to speak. And so,
that sounds like more fun than it is, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. I think that what we're afraid of is that the future that we have nostalgia for won't happen. That the world that we thought we were promised won't come about. That it's going to be different, and that's scary. And we don't know what that's.
So what's that world that we were promised?
I think in an institution where we have tenure, you know, it's kind of the idea that, like, you will achieve tenure, you will prove your excellence, and you will then be granted, you know, have a position like you were promised for the rest of your life, or as long as you want it, I should say. And what's happening is that adjuncts and lecturers and non-tenure track faculty are kind of coming in, and the idea is that if we have these what I've called paint by numbers teaching, and others have called classes in a can, where we can just have, you know, you were a police officer before, so you must understand sociology. Here, teach 101 at this school, which, you know, is not an exaggeration. It's certainly is happening. Somewhere right now. And I think that we're afraid that that's going to happen everywhere. And we're afraid that, like, I think that the idea is that if we can just hold on to what we have, if we can hold on to our intellectual property tighter, then we can keep our jobs, which is reminiscent to me of, well, if we can just stop people from using Napster, we can keep selling CDs and the world won't change. You know, and unfortunately, as we can, if you can talk to the record industry, the world did change. And it changed because of technology. And so we're in a very similar type of position where the world's going to change. Academia might be slow to change, slow to warm up to, you know, the revolution, so to speak. I hate to use that word. But the revolution that the internet might be providing. And actually, I should be more specific here. I don't think academia as a whole is scared of technology or scared of the revolution. I think administrators and especially for-profit schools are diving headfirst into technology, into that revolution. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the people that I am in contact with are educators themselves, and that's a kind of a stressful a place to be. And I think that if I argue that educators need to dive headfirst into technology, that we need to be on the forefront of that, because we can either drag our heels and hope that the world doesn't change, and then it does. Or we can say, look, we're going to go head first, and we're going to figure out a way that we can, you know, increase our value and, you know, I guess, use this this revolution. And the big thing I think that we have to talk about is the idea that, like, this kind of gets to the third point that I was talking about before, but that are you replaceable by a website or a video recording or anything like that? Because if you are, then, I mean, you have a lot to be afraid of. Then your fears are not anxieties. They are genuine fears. And how could we make ourselves irreplaceable? How can we make ourselves how can we make a future that we can be happy with? And I think the answer is, this is just my opinion, but I think that the answer is that bring our humanity into the classroom. Because humanity cannot be replaced by technology. I mean, Marx 101, right? That, like, we can alienate teaching, or we can, you know, use technology to humanize teaching.
I think you're way too pessimistic about the future state of robots. And robot teachers will eventually rule us all. But aside from that, the more immediate future. Right. No, I mean, this is the doomsday scenario, right? And I've thought about this a lot, where you can imagine, pick your university. Your university no longer hires professors, right? Or your for-profit university or your local college. They license a multimedia course from the star professor at Harvard, right? You get the video, you get the book, you get all of the lectures, you get everything in this great, you know, this great packet. And then all you need to do as a college is just hire, low paying teaching assistants, basically, to administer the course. You know, they make sure people are doing their work. They do the boring grading. And, you know, there's this vision where you're going to end up with a few academics who maybe have the freedom to really teach, you know, and do what we've always done. But then, life for actual instructors is going to be really, really rough. But you're sort of saying, well, I mean, this is why I like your talk about humanity, kidding about robots and all aside.
Right.
Is that, what you miss then is that sort of personal connection with a lot of what comes from being a sociology major is interacting with your fellow students in a classroom setting and interacting with your professor, you know,
right.
And, you know, I think, you know, I'm at a big university, Minnesota. We have huge classes, but it's a research institution. But, you know, most, if not all, of our professors really care about actually interacting with students and forming face-to-face, you know, relationships. So I think, like,
absolutely.
I think we already know this. We just have this great anxiety that that's not enough, right?
Right. I mean, you and I would both be foolish if we said, well, no one's going to lose their job and no one's going to be affected by this and there's not going to be changes. There's, of course, going to be changes. I mean, I guess, but in the end, if we all can agree that changes are coming, I guess the question we should all ask ourselves professionally is, which side of that change do you want to be on? I mean, do you want to be replaceable or do you want to be irreplaceable? And I'm going for the latter. I'm going for making human connections with as many people as possible. And, one of the things that people also kind of countered with is that there's no, I think a quote was, there's no brownie points for being an amazing teacher, right? For doing teaching with humanity. In the end, it's not recognized. You know, it's not on your performance merit evaluation. And that might be true. Actually, and that's not even might be true. That is true in a lot of instances. But the connections you make with other human beings and the connection you make with the community that you're surrounding, they will be the things that support you in the end. And I really have to wonder that if you're not focused on that, then I guess you don't teach sociology like I understand it. I think that sociology specifically, and I'm sure almost every single teacher in every single discipline would say this, but sociology is inherently about contextualization in socialization and seeing things at the social level. And so if you are staring at a laptop alone in a room, it's really kind of hard to do that. It's hard to have those social experiences. And while I think it's probably going to happen, and it's happening, actually, I think it's happening right now, that someone's probably at this moment staring at a computer screen learning about sociology, there's always going to be an opportunity. And if that's not the mass market opportunity it is today and it becomes a niche opportunity, then maybe it does become a niche opportunity. But complaining about it isn't an effective strategy.
Yeah. I mean, there will always be people who are strong self-learners and can learn whatever they need to learn from a book. But, you know, books have been around for a long time, too. And there's probably there's similar fear when the printing press came around, right?
Right.
If we could just, you know, copy down our lectures and read them all, then why would anyone ever want to go to a lecture, right?
Right. Well, and I think with one thing that I've kind of failed to mention up to now, and I'm sure many people know this, but, you know, MIT puts all of their software online, or all of their classware online, all of their classes. You can watch videos. You can do, if you want to take a course at MIT, it's available to you now. And still somehow MIT has students. And of course you can say, well, they're MIT. Who am I? You know, we're just a small institution. We're just, you know, yada, yada, yada. And maybe that's true. But, you know, no one sees the opportunities that are available before they become available. You know, it's like no one, like I told my students just yesterday, this is kind of a tangent, but no one thought that there could be a musical show on television. And then there was Glee. You know what I mean? No one thought it would ever be popular. And then there was Glee. You know, all technologies like that. You know, you could never have every CD you ever owned in your pocket. And then you could. And so the things that we don't, you know, the problem with anticipating how the things are going to change and then having anxiety about it is that it assumes that things will always stay the way that they are. And the only thing that we know, you know, on one level is that everything's going to change. And so I guess we've kind of wandered away from a class pack, but...
Well, a little bit. I mean, I guess here's the question to you then. What you're doing is you're teaching, and then you're taking a lot of the stuff that you're already using, and you're using the internet to help you do that better, right? You're sharing your stuff with other people. You're writing blog posts and blogging regularly about teaching and trying to help other people. Is this just a completely selfless act because you just love to talk and love to write? Or are you getting, I mean, what are you getting out of this? And why should others do the same thing? Why shouldn't they just read sociology source, get all their ideas and, you know, and not do the same back? In other words, like, are you trying to say that what you're doing is what we should all be doing? Or are you just saying, you know, what are you getting out of it?
That's a great question. Well, what do I get out of it?
I mean, we already established you're not getting rich.
Indeed. No. So. It's costing, not making at the moment. What do I get out of it? I get to engage with supremely interesting people like yourself and others who have contacted me. And I've had the privilege of meeting a whole host of people that I would never have met otherwise. And I've had opportunities come my way that would never have come my way before. And all of those things have, I mean, I already feel like, and I know that some people are, this is going to be an eye roller, so brace yourselves, but I really feel like I have like one of the greatest jobs in the world. I love everything about what I do. And so I started there, and then I said, I love this so much that I want someone, I hope other people can feel as awesome all the time about their job as I do. And maybe if I kind of showed people what's been working for me, maybe that would be a fast track to making them happy. And they could, you know, enjoy it as well. And in the process, the response that I've gotten from people, the people I've been in connections with, the people that I've Skyped with, and the, you know, the other bloggers who I've, you know, met and got to talk with, and the exchange of ideas has been insanely rewarding. I've looked forward to every single thing that I've done, and I've tried to make it as awesome as possible, just because I want to give back. And the other thing is, I thought this didn't start out about getting; it started out about giving. And the idea is that I am a believer. I have seen with my own eyes that students' lives can change in a classroom. that students can see the world one way and then change it over the course of a semester sometimes. And sometimes you don't get to see it. Sometimes they come back to you like 2 years later and they said, you know, I hated your class, but everything you said to me, man, that really changed the way I, like, now I'm ready for it. And all of that is fulfilling in a way that, like, I think of, you know, my friends and family who have jobs that, you know, they're not really excited about and that they kind of have to go to and that they would choose probably not to do. And I get to do a job where I get to maybe even change someone's life, you know, and I don't take that as a, I guess, a self-aggrandizing or like, you know, I'm awesome kind of thing. I take that as I was so fortunate to get to be in the room and maybe be a catalyst for that change, but I don't take responsibility for that change. The students make that change. And so if you believe that, if you believe that it's possible to change the world, that one student at a time, one community at a time, then take that to mass. You know, take that to... so I put this... I had an experience in a classroom that changed a student's life. Then I take that activity, I put that on the internet, and then other people use it. And maybe they have that same experience. And so I call it like open source classware, you know, sometimes. But the other idea is that like I'm serving these ideas. I'm a servant to sociology. I believe with in the you know deepest part of my soul that what we have in this country more than anything else, what the deficiency we have is that we can only see at the individual level. And that if we could actually open our eyes to the sociological level, to the social level, and we could see the value in that, then we would make better decisions. We would make more informed decisions. And I think that once you see it at that level, and if you accept it as reality, it's hard to be intolerant. It's hard not to accept somebody. It's hard to exploit. It's hard to not be peaceful. And all of those things are good things. And again, I don't see myself as some sort of like... you know, savior in any kind of way. I just simply think that, you know, that I have seen people get eyes for sociology and how that affects them. And I want more people to get that. And so I serve the ideas. I serve the experience I have. And in a way, you ask kind of what I get out of it. It's a return. I get to honor my students' effort and honor the people and educators who trained me and got me to this point by helping others. The interesting thing about, I guess what I'm proposing is that teach sociology as social change, like as a movement, like somehow there's a giant disconnect. I always say that the worst chapter in every single intro textbook is the last one where they're like, okay, now do something with it. You know what I mean? Or and they just go, well, social movements are this, and sometimes social changes happen this way. And it's like, but everyone's like, well, so now what? What do I do now? Mm-hmm. And I started off maybe 2 or 3 years ago telling, you know, coming up with answers to that question and trying to give that to students. And I can't say, you know, here's a recipe for success. I can simply say, here are the things that, you know, if you start heading this way, you'll probably find your solution, not this is the way to go. And the idea behind this is that, you know, at one moment I was kind of thinking to myself, what am I really doing? And I realized that there are many sociologists out there who are very involved in their communities and very, you know, involved in nonprofits and everything like that. So I'm not critiquing other people. I'm simply talking about myself here. And I wasn't doing a whole lot. And I thought, how can I give something and how can I actually put up and, you know, what I'm, you know, put up or shut up, actually do something. And that's where this all came about. You know, I signed up for a blog account and I started writing down the activities that I was using. I also had some pretty distinct ideas about, I think, how sociology might be being taught and how that might be, I guess, antithetical to, you know, a lot of the messages we teach. And also it might be promoting, you know, some what I would call not best practices. So if I can just transition into that, I guess. Like, for example, the class pack, it has slides that are images or graphical representations of the concepts that I'm talking about, as opposed to like bullet points. You know, I think that when we use bullet points, I mean, I think most professors hate bullet points. Like, if they were sitting in the audience and then the someone that they have to, you know, listen to goes, and now I'd like to show you the fourth quarter report, click, and then on comes all these bullet points. It's like, oh, God, please no. But then at the same time, it's like, well, that's kind of how I teach my class.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the challenge is okay, if we can say that that's not a good, you know, and if there's actually some research that suggests that it's too much of a cognitive load to read a slide, write it down, listen and think, and then also participate in a conversation simultaneously, that we can't do all of that, then what do we do? And I don't have the answer to that question. I do have maybe a step in that, what I think might be the right direction, which is, so all of my slides are graphical. Almost all of them, 98% of them, are graphical, and they inspire the emotion behind what I'm saying, not provide the information to what I'm saying. And so, but then the next question is, well, do you just give away your notes? Because then why would anyone come to your class, besides you being a awesome, well-cleaned, so to speak, you know, or well, impeccable hygiene,
yes,
and approachable person, as we talked about earlier. And then, instead of giving them the notes, because, you know, it's especially in an intro class, I mean, it needs to be more of a guided experience. This isn't, you know, a senior level course. They're not ready to kind of walk on their own yet, so to speak. And so I created what I call note sheets, which are, you know, on some level just worksheets that they follow along. But as I'm talking in class and as they're reading and as they're in their class activities and the class discussions, they can write down, you know, they can, there's like a question like, asking them to apply a concept to something else or to something in their real life, and then they can write that down. So it's more of a guided experience that we get. It takes the best part about bullet points, which are, here's what I think you should know, and it takes away the worst part, which is you should just be, you know, a human copy machine and just copy down every single thing you see. And the real benefits of that are, I talk about, when I talk about racism and race and discrimination and prejudice, I always have a lecture that is the last 12 months of news events about race. I've had students, and actually I wrote about this on Teaching in the Social World as well, but I've had students before, many students I would say, who ask, is racism something that haven't we overcome this? Haven't we come so far? And isn't this a thing of the past? And, you know, people have kind of critiqued that and said, well, do you mean that you've had white students who've said that? And no, I've had students of all racial ethnic groups. Now, I would say that white students are more predisposed to that line of thinking, in my experience, but that does not mean that they are exclusively the ones. So, what I do to kind of counteract that is I take the last 12 months of news events, like maybe it's, I can't think of her name all of a sudden, the doctor radio lady who said the N-word 16 times, Laura Schlesinger.
Yeah.
So Dr. Laura, right? So she said the N-word like 16 times in a row. And so, I mean, I talk about that. Or in, I believe it was Mississippi, they had a presidential, a student council election, and they set by race who could be in what position. So you had to be white to be president. And like each, it was prescribed based on race what role you could have, and they said that was a effort to encourage diversity, even though you could not be a non-white person to be president of that junior high. And so I talk about that.
That's fascinating. I missed that one somehow.
I can email it to you, and you can put it in the show notes if you want. So the point is that instead of telling the students about that, because, I mean, right now as you're hearing this, right, you kind of have to imagine it, and it's like, oh, okay, that's whatever it is. But if I show you, like, here's the form. Here's the photo of the form. This is what it looked like, you know. And if I can play you the radio clip that Laura Schlesinger said, or, you know, in Missouri during this month, you know, Black History Month, there was at UC Santa Barbara, UC San Diego, I can't remember which one, it was one of the UC schools, they hung a noose in the library, and then they had what they called the Compton Cookout, which was where everyone could come, this is a direct quote, everyone could come and be an N-word for a day.
Yeah.
Right? That was the party message.
Yeah.
And then in Missouri, at the University of Missouri, they had two ROTC students spread cotton balls in front of the Black Culture Center. And so in all of those instances, instead of saying racism is bad and here's a bullet point that tells you what happened, I showed the picture of the cotton balls in front of the Black Culture Center. I showed the invitation to that event. And in doing so, you return the emotion and you return the experience to what it is, as opposed to a single dot with some text following it. And so that's a kind of one of the ideas that I have about where, and it's not my idea specifically, but one of the things I think we can do with sociology, and that giving away the class pack was an idea of saying, here's how I'm teaching sociology, and maybe the innovation that I have isn't right yet. And I call it open source classware in a lot of ways, to kind of piggyback off the idea of open source software, where we see this rapid innovation, where someone takes an idea and someone else says, huh, that's clever, but it would be a lot more effective if we did it this way. And then someone else says, yeah, that's good too, but what if it did this as well? And then we get things like Linux, which runs about every single thing that, you know, is on a computer. Like, is like your remote probably runs Linux. All of these things. And I want that kind of innovation in teaching.
Mm-hmm. The PowerPoint thing in particular, I mean, that's a great example. Because, you know, you go to conferences, you teach, you see other people teach, and they all have the bullet points. And the bullet points are so easy, too, because, and I think this is a lot of it, is that I sit down and plan out a lecture, and I do an outline. So it just seems natural that I just take the outline and put it on slides, and, you know, why not? And it becomes like, that's what you do. Oh, I was just going to say, like, that, it becomes like that's what you do, and when you can't see other examples of how to do it.
Right. And that goes kind of back to what I'm saying about leveraging technology to teach with humanity. You know, it is, in a sense, we dehumanize the experience when we just make it into text. You know, maybe we can describe it really well, but when we show students what we're talking about, when we show or have them see it or hear it or experience it on their own, then it you know, brings some humanity back to it. It's, of course, still a dehumanized experience. It's a digital image. I know that, but it's a lot closer, and I think that it's... It increases, I guess, the value of what we provide,
which is what we're all about.
That's right.
I won't end on that sarcastic note. Sorry.
No.
It's always a challenge when you feel like you come to a moment where you can wrap it up to wrap it up in a non cheesy way. And I go for the cheese.
Yeah. Well,
this has been a great talk, actually. So
I thank you so much. This has been wonderful, and I apologize for rambling, which I as everyone who knows me can tell you, I'm afflicted with.
Podcasts are made for rambling.
You know, I guess if there was something to leave with, is that I just wanted to kind of say that I feel like that. If I had a microphone for a second and I could say something to an audience of sociology teachers, what I'd love to tell them would be that, you know, the things that I'm doing isn't really unique or special. You know, it's not something that you couldn't do as well. And it's just a matter of, you know, kind of getting over the fear. You know, one of the big things that I guess that we haven't even talked about yet is, why is it that it's so uncomfortable to talk about teaching? And why is it so uncomfortable to talk about our experiences in the classroom? And I think it's because, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of having like a colleague or, you know, someone who you might call an expert in the room while you're talking. Mm-hmm. But there's this big fear, and I believe it's fostered through conferences where we see this kind of banter between you know, colleagues and peers and experts, mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, well, you didn't teach that actually right, or you made a mistake, or, you know... You clearly show your bias by only talking about this aspect of gender and not these other aspects. And I think that one of the big challenges to getting people to share like this is to just acknowledge the fact that I am not perfect. I am a work in progress. I say things in my class almost daily that totally escape my radar, that make someone feel a way that I don't want them to feel. I isolate people. You know, I guess this is an audio podcast, but I'm a white male, and there's a worldview that's associated with my experiences as a white male, and I have to acknowledge that and work with it. But in the end, I don't think I'm alone in that. I think that other people are also struggling with the same thing, and hiding that is not necessarily going to get us to kind of evolve out of it or grow in any kind of way. But teaching is hard. And many of us have limited professional training on how to teach, and it's intimidating to put yourself out there. But what I'd love to say to everybody is that it's open, it's available. My website, Sociology Source, has a link about participation. So if you want to participate, you absolutely can. And you know, join it, man. If it's a movement, then and you're a sociologist, right? So you know all about social movements. Then join me. Let's do it. You know, let's do something fun.
Can't think of a better way to end that.
All right.
That was great.
Kind of cheesy at the end, but
that's okay. I'm a sucker for the cheese. So.
All right. Good.
Office hours are over for the week. To subscribe to this podcast or to learn more about the research discussed today, check out our website at thesocietypages.org/officehours. As always, thanks to my fellow TSP podcasters, the U of M's College of Liberal Arts for their generous hosting and support, and thanks to you, yes, you, for listening. See you soon.
Sometimes,
you know.
Damn it. Like it was so right there.